Well, welcome back to our Old Testament survey. We're going through the books of the Old Testament in the order that they appear in the Hebrew Bible. So where we are in the physical Bible is not necessarily indicative of how close we are to finishing. But this evening, as we continue to work our way through this third grouping of books known as the Writings, we find ourselves in the book of Ecclesiastes. Now, the writings are meant to teach us how to live as God's people. And so, as we approach the book of Ecclesiastes, we're going to seek what wisdom lies here for us and how to live our lives. It's commonly held that Solomon is the author of the book, though his name is never used. But the self-descriptions that the author gives us fit well with what we know of King Solomon. If we look at Ecclesiastes 1:1, the author identifies himself. He says, "The words of the preacher, the son of David, king in Jerusalem." So he calls himself a preacher. He also names himself the son of David, who is king in Jerusalem. Later in the chapter, in verse 12, we read a little more. He says, "I, the preacher, was king over Israel and Jerusalem. And I set my heart to seek and search out by wisdom concerning all that is done under heaven. This burdensome task God has given to the sons of man, by which they may be exercised. I have seen all the works that are done under the sun, and indeed all is vanity and grasping for the wind." Now, some scholars look at this, particularly the past tense phrase, "was king over Israel and Jerusalem," there in verse 12, and come to the conclusion that the author was not Solomon, but rather was likely Zedekiah, and that he wrote this after he had been taken into captivity in Babylon. But I don't think that that actually fits, because the next section seems to clearly indicate to me that Solomon is the only one who actually fits the description that the author is giving of himself. He says in verse 16, "I communed with my heart, saying, 'Look, I have attained greatness and have gained more wisdom than all who were before me in Jerusalem. My heart has understood great wisdom and knowledge, and I set my heart to know wisdom and to know madness and folly. I perceived that this also is grasping for the wind.'" So, given that Solomon was said to be the wisest one that had lived, it seems to me that the description fits Solomon very well. But as we continue to read what he has to say to us, if we go back to chapter 1, verse 2, we can get a taste for kind of the flavor of the book. He says, "Vanity of vanities," says the preacher, "vanity of vanities, all is vanity. What profit has a man from all his labor in which he toils under the sun? One generation passes away and another generation comes, but the earth abides forever. The sun also rises and the sun goes down and hastens to the place where it arose. The wind goes towards the south and turns around to the north. The wind whirls about continually and comes again on its circuit. All the rivers run into the sea, yet the sea is not full. To the place from which the rivers come, there they return again. All things are full of labor. Man cannot express it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor the ear filled with hearing. That which has been is what will be. That which is done is what will be done. And there is nothing new under the sun." That's a pretty bleak picture that he's painting. It sounds somewhat hopeless and not very encouraging. Generations come and go, he says there in verse 4. The days turn one day into the next as the sun rises and sets over and over again. The wind blows this way and that way. Water flows around the earth from the rivers into the oceans and back to the source. Nothing new ever happens. People forget the past. He says in verse 11, "There is no remembrance of former things, nor will there be any remembrance of things that are to come by those who will come after." So life is just one ceaseless repetition after another. And to give you a somewhat modern, from the 1930s, spin on Ecclesiastes, I would quote to you the wisdom of the comedian George Carlin, who said, "Dusting is a good example of the futility of trying to set things right. As soon as you dust, the fact of your next dusting has already been established." That seems to be where Solomon is going with this. You're just doing the same things over and over again in life, and it seems futile to him. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. So when we come to a book like this, one that is this bleak, how are we supposed to read this? What are we supposed to gain from this book of wisdom? This is part of our wisdom literature. So what wisdom is contained in here? For what purpose was it written? Is there any good theology to be found? I mean, we saw in the book of Job as we went through it that much of the book of Job, the counsel that his friends gave him, was actually not good theology. So is that true in Ecclesiastes? Some people believe that is the case in Ecclesiastes. I don't particularly, but as we get into the book of Ecclesiastes, we do need to make ourselves aware of how we should not read the book. And this generally applies to all of the wisdom literature, including Proverbs and Job, and that is that we should not read books like this in bits and pieces. We need to read them as a whole so that we get the overall picture and we can put the bits and pieces in their proper context. Otherwise, we might be liable to take something out of its context and misconstrue the purpose and come away with the wrong idea. For instance, if we look at chapter 3 here in Ecclesiastes, probably the most famous part of the book, chapter 3, beginning in verse 1 and going through verse 8, it says, "To everything there is a season, a time for every purpose under heaven, a time to be born and a time to die, a time to plant and a time to pluck what is planted, a time to kill and a time to heal, a time to break down and a time to build up, a time to weep and a time to laugh, a time to mourn and a time to dance, a time to cast away stones and a time to gather stones, a time to embrace and a time to refrain from embracing, a time to gain and a time to lose, a time to keep and a time to throw away, a time to tear and a time to sow, a time to keep silence and a time to speak, a time to love and a time to hate, a time of war and a time of peace." These verses are often quoted in movies. I remember particularly watching a Western with my grandfather when I was a kid, and the good guys read this verse and determined it was the time for war. It was the time to go kill the bad guys. These verses are also quite popular and well-known as the lyrics that were set to music by Pete Seeger back in the 1950s and then made popular by the Byrds when they released their album Turn, Turn, Turn in 1965. Which went to number one on the Billboard charts and still holds the distinction of being the Billboard number one hit song with the oldest lyrics. Seeger, of course, intended the song to be a call for world peace. That was his purpose in it. The Westerns who are quoting it are finding in these verses a time to kill and a time to go to war. But in the book of Ecclesiastes, the context of these lyrics is in a discourse concerning, as Gordon Fee says in his commentary, the transitory, elusive nature of human life. It is about the ebb and flow of human life and activity and how they are set by God and thus outside of human control. So you can see what happens if you take the words out of their context. They end up being a pretext for violence or a call for world peace, when the irony of it is they were actually intended to teach us the truth of God's sovereignty in all things and our own insignificance on the world stage, not our ability to bring peace on earth. So Pete Seeger absolutely took the verses out of context and meant something quite contrary to what Solomon meant by them. The other issue with reading in bits and pieces is that you can end up taking as biblical truth that which was intended to be understood as an incorrect understanding of life. And we see that throughout the book of Job as his friends counsel him with bad theology and bad philosophy about life. And if you were to take something there without reading all the way to the end where God says that those friends were wrong, you could end up believing something incorrect. The same is true here in Ecclesiastes. If you were to read almost any part of the book in isolation prior to the ending in chapter 12, you could end up believing something incorrectly because you don't have the context and you don't have the conclusions. As we have already said, the book was likely written by Solomon. He was the wisest and the wealthiest king that Israel ever knew. And so in Ecclesiastes, he is sharing with us his search for meaning in life. And it would appear that he's having trouble finding it. So let's look at some of the things that he turns to in his search for meaning. We already read the section there in chapter 1, but if we look at chapter 2, beginning in verse 1, it says this, "I said in my heart, come now, I will test you with mirth. Therefore, enjoy pleasure. But surely this also was vanity. I said of laughter, madness, and of mirth, what does it accomplish? I searched in my heart how to gratify my flesh with wine while guiding my heart with wisdom, and how to lay hold on folly till I might see what was good for the sons of men to do under heaven all the days of their lives. I made my works great. I built myself houses and planted myself vineyards. I made myself gardens and orchards. I planted all kinds of fruit trees in them. I made myself water pools from which to water the growing trees of the grove. I acquired male and female servants and had servants born in my house. Yes, I had greater possessions of herds and flocks than all who were in Jerusalem before me. I also gathered for myself silver and gold and the special treasures of kings and of provinces. I acquired male and female singers, the delights of the sons of men, and musical instruments of all kind." So he searches for meaning in the pursuit of pleasure. He seeks pleasure, mirth, laughter, food, entertainment, alcohol. He sought meaning in life from his accomplishments. He built houses, he planted vineyards, he accumulated wealth and possessions in greater quantities than any king before him. And through all of this, he says that he kept his wisdom so that he was able to discern the value of any of this. In verse 9, "So I became great and excelled more than all who were before me in Jerusalem. Also, my wisdom remained with me. Whatever my eyes desired, I did not keep from them. I did not withhold my heart from any pleasure, for my heart rejoiced in all my labor. And this was my reward from all my labor. Then I looked on all the works that my hands had done and on the labor in which I had toiled, and indeed all was vanity and grasping for the wind. There was no profit under the sun." So he determines that all of life is futile. No ultimate meaning or satisfaction is to be found in pleasure and wealth and accomplishment and entertainment and any of these things. And on the heels of the Song of Solomon, this is somewhat sobering. The Song of Solomon was all about joy and pleasure in the marriage union, and yet here he is in Ecclesiastes telling us that if you look for your ultimate identity and meaning in life, in those things, in joy, in pleasure, then ultimately, in the end, it will leave you empty and hollow because you won't find your ultimate meaning and satisfaction there. Next, he turns to his own intellect and wisdom for meaning in life. In verse 12, "Then I turned myself to consider wisdom and madness and folly. For what can the man do who succeeds the king? Only what he has already done. Then I saw that wisdom excels folly as light excels darkness. The wise man's eyes are in his head, but the fool walks in darkness. Yet I myself perceived that the same event happens to them all." So he concludes that wisdom is better than folly, but he also saw that both the wise and the foolish person come to the same end. So he says in verse 15, "So I said in my heart, as it happens to the fool, it also happens to me. And why was I then more wise? Then I said in my heart, this also is vanity. For there is no more remembrance of the wise than of the fool forever, since all that now is will be forgotten in the days to come. And how does a wise man die? As the fool. Therefore I hated life, because the work that was done under the sun was distressing to me, for all is vanity and grasping for the wind." So he despairs of finding meaning in this life because he has found no satisfaction in pleasure, in possessions, in accomplishments, in his own wisdom even. There is nothing to be satisfied with. They all mean nothing. He will leave them to someone else who has not labored for them. He tells us in verse 18, "Then I hated all my labor in which I had toiled under the sun, because I must leave it to the man who will come after me. And who knows whether he will be wise or a fool? Yet he will rule over all my labor in which I toiled and in which I have shown myself wise under the sun. This also is vanity." So he can't take it with him, as the saying goes. He has to leave it behind, and he has no guarantee that the next one who takes his place as king will rule wisely or use what he leaves behind in a wise way. All that he had worked for in this life could be squandered by a fool who comes after him. And so he determines that all you can do is try to enjoy the work that God has given you to do in the moment and not think about the vanity of it. He says in verse 24, "Nothing is better for a man than that he should eat and drink, and that his soul should enjoy good in his labor. This also I saw was from the hand of God. For who can eat or who can have enjoyment more than I? For God gives wisdom and knowledge and joy to a man who is good in his sight, but to the sinner he gives the work of gathering and collecting, that he may give to him who is good before God. This also is vanity and grasping for the wind." And so he says, God is the one who gives those things that we have in life, and so we should enjoy them in the sight of God as gifts from the hand of God, but it still is all vanity because it doesn't last. And so then we come to the passage in chapter 3, which we spoke of earlier, where he is reflecting now on the subject of time and how fleeting our lives are. Life has its ups and downs. We have no control over them. And after this, he says that God has put eternity in our hearts. He says in chapter 3, verse 9, "What profit has the worker from that which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from the beginning to end." In other words, we know there's something beyond this world. God has created us with an innate sense and knowledge of eternity, and yet we don't know it. We have no knowledge of what comes after this life, apart from what God has revealed in His Word, obviously. But it is beyond our knowledge, it's beyond our wisdom, it's beyond our understanding, it's beyond our control. And so what are we to do in the midst of this cycle of repeating joy and sorrow and labor? How are we to respond to all of this? And he says again in verse 12, "I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives. And also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God." So we are to enjoy the life that God has given us and await that eternity that we know in our hearts is coming. But this isn't a license to do wickedly in this life. Just because he's telling us to enjoy the life that God is giving us, that does not mean that we can do wickedly in life. And so he says in verse 17, "I said in my heart, God shall judge the righteous and the wicked, for there is a time there for every purpose and for every work." So God, in the end, will judge. Yes, you enjoy life now in the flesh, but with the knowledge of a coming judgment when you will stand before a holy God. And then he says in verse 22, "So I perceived that nothing is better than that a man should rejoice in his own works, for that is his heritage. For who can bring him to see what will happen after?" So that's his conclusion at this point. Enjoy life, enjoy the blessings that God has given us in this life, but with a knowledge that there is a day of judgment coming. But then the preacher turns his attention to contemplating the state of the world and all of the oppression that happens in the world. In chapter 4, verses 1 through 3, he says, "Then I returned and considered all the oppression that is done under the sun. And look, the tears of the oppressed, but they have no comforter. On the side of their oppressors there is power, but they have no comforter. Therefore I praised the dead who were already dead, more than the living who are still alive. Yet better than both is he who has never existed, who has not seen the evil work that is done under the sun." Now, again, we have to read Ecclesiastes as a whole, follow his train of thought to the end, so that we know what he is actually saying. But I have actually heard people who claim to be Christians, claim to believe the Bible, turn to verse 3 here in Ecclesiastes 4 and take this to mean that abortion is actually merciful, because the unborn child would then not have to experience all the pain and suffering of living this life. That's the danger of not reading this book to the end and understanding what Solomon's final conclusion actually is that you can make mistakes like that. We have to follow his thoughts through to see where he ends up. The point here is that from a human perspective, without an understanding of life beyond this life, things do seem futile and vain, and life doesn't always go the way that it should. People are cruel to each other, the wicked prosper, and if this is all there is to existence, you might be better off dead or never having been born. But that isn't the end of the story. In the midst of this life of sorrow, oppression, and vanity, there are good things, things of value, that things that God has given us as good gifts. Now, he's already spoken of those things, the labor that he has given us, the benefits of that labor. But in chapter 4, he mentions a few others. In verse 9, he says, "Two are better than one because they have good reward for their labor. For if they fall, one will lift up his companion. But woe to him who is alone when he falls, for he has no one to help him up. Again, if two lie down together, they will keep warm. But how can one be warm alone? Though one may be overpowered by another, two can withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." My dad liked to quote that passage to us boys when we were growing up. He was trying to teach us to stick together and help each other out and to recognize the value of teamwork and not always going it alone. And so Solomon is teaching us that there are good things in life, and one of those good things is companionship and friendship and the value of working together with others for a common cause. He also learns, though, that popularity will not give you lasting significance. Even a king who is praised in his youth is not always popular near the end of his reign, and we see that in the end of chapter 4. In verse 13, he says, "Better is a poor and wise youth than an old and foolish king who will be admonished no more, for he comes out of prison to be king, although he was born poor in his kingdom. I saw the living who walk under the sun. They were with the second youth who stands in his place. There was no end of all the people over whom he was made king, yet those who come afterward will not rejoice in him. Surely this also is vanity and grasping for the wind." So it would be better to be poor and wise, understanding life, than to be a foolish king who enjoys popularity for a season, but is ultimately rejected by the people when he is older. In chapter 5, he then addresses the subject of religion. And as we saw in Proverbs, there is a great emphasis on controlling your mouth, controlling your words. Chapter 5, verse 1, "Walk prudently when you go in the house of God, and draw near to hear rather than to give the sacrifice of fools, for they do not know that they do evil." So he tells us that we are to walk prudently when we come to the house of God, and that we are to come to hear God communicate and speak to us through his word rather than simply to hear ourselves talk. That's what he means by the sacrifice of fools. And then he says in verse 2, "Do not be rash with your mouth, and let not your heart utter anything hastily before God, for God is in heaven and you on earth. Therefore, let your words be few, for a dream comes through much activity, and a fool's voice is known by his many words. When you make a vow to God, do not delay to pay it, for he has no pleasure in fools. Pay what you have vowed. Better not to vow than to vow and not pay. Do not let your mouth cause your flesh to sin, nor say before the messenger of God that it was an error. Why should God be angry at your excuse and destroy the work of your hands? For in the multitude of dreams and many words, there is also vanity. But fear God." So Ecclesiastes is really beginning to sound like Proverbs at this point. Wisdom is found in the fear of the Lord. We are to keep a watch and a guard over our mouths. And again, he speaks of the vanity of seeking after wealth and possessions. In verse 10, "He who loves silver will not be satisfied with silver, nor he who loves abundance with increase. This also is vanity." And he comes to the same conclusion that he did before in verse 18. "Here is what I have seen. It is good and fitting for one to eat and drink and to enjoy the good of all his labor in which he toils under the sun all the days of his life which God gives him, for it is his heritage." But he also concludes that wealth is a gift from God, best enjoyed rather than hoarded, because you can't take it with you. So he says in verse 19, "As for every man to whom God has given riches and wealth and given him power to eat of it, to receive his heritage and rejoice in his labor, this is the gift of God. for he will not dwell unduly on the days of his life, because God keeps him busy with the joy of his heart. But some are given wealth and not the opportunity to enjoy the blessings that God has given them. It's eaten up by others, and this is another evil that he has witnessed in the world. In chapter 6, verse 1, there is an evil which I have seen under the sun, and it is common among men. A man to whom God has given riches and wealth and honor, so that he lacks nothing for himself of all he desires, yet God does not give him power to eat of it, but a foreigner consumes it. This is vanity, and it is an evil affliction. And then chapter 6 ends with the conclusion that life is just a shadow. It's wispy, it's elusive, it's lacking in substance, it is all vanity, says in verse 12. For who knows what is good for man in life? All the days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow, who can tell a man what will happen after him under the sun? And then chapter 7 begins the second half of the book with another poem. Life consists of birth and death, feasting and mourning, joy and sorrow. Which is better? Is it better to feast and be joyful, or is it better to mourn and be sorrowful? He concludes that mourning and sorrow are better. Why? Because those things give us wisdom and insight, and fools don't gain that wisdom because they're busy with the fleeting pleasures of mirth and laughter. A good name, he says in chapter 7, verse 1, is better than precious ointment, the day of death than the day of one's birth. Better to go to the house of mourning than to go to the house of feasting, for that is the end of all men, and the living will take it to heart. Sorrow is better than laughter, for by a sad countenance the heart is made better. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, but the heart of fools is in the house of mirth. Both good and bad come from the hand of God, so enjoy the good and learn from the bad. Only God knows the future. We don't know if tomorrow will be good or evil. And so he says in verse 13, consider the work of God, for who can make straight what he has made crooked? In the day of prosperity, be joyful, but in the day of adversity, consider. Surely God has appointed the one as well as the other, so that man can find out nothing that will come after him. So now comes a bit of a confusing passage, which again, we have to be careful when we read it so that we don't arrive at the wrong conclusion. He says in verse 15, I have seen everything in my days of vanity. There is a just man who perishes in his righteousness, and there is a wicked man who prolongs life in his wickedness. Do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? Do not be overly wicked, nor be foolish. Why should you die before your time? It is good that you grasp this, and also not remove your hand from the other, for he who fears God will escape them all. Now, he is not arguing for mediocrity. I have heard some people say that that's what he's saying here. Don't try and be too good. Just make sure that you're not too bad, somewhere in the middle. That's not what Solomon is trying to teach us here. He's not saying that we should aim for sinning just a little bit, but not too much, and doing some good, but not too much good. What he means is that the just man and the wicked man both have no control over the length of their lives. That's what he says in verse 15. But being overly wicked and foolish can lead to an early death. That's what he says in verse 17. And then the confusing part is verse 16, do not be overly righteous, nor be overly wise. Why should you destroy yourself? And I think what he means here is to be legalistically strict with yourself in a sort of self-righteousness that was practiced by the Pharisees in Jesus' day, which will ensure that you don't enjoy life the way God intended and that you won't actually be righteous in any way, so don't do that. Now, this is the sort of righteousness that Paul practiced before he became a Christian. He wrote of himself in Philippians 3, if anyone else thinks he may have confidence in the flesh, I have more so. Circumcised the eighth day, of the stock of Israel, of the tribe of Benjamin, a Hebrew of Hebrews, concerning the law, a Pharisee, concerning zeal, persecuting the church, concerning the righteousness which is in the law, blameless. This is the sort of over-righteousness that Solomon is talking about in Ecclesiastes, the righteousness that the Pharisees had, that they were righteous in their own eyes because they kept all these strict rules that they had made for themselves, but they did not actually enjoy the blessings of God because they did not know what the fear of the Lord was. Wisdom will help you avoid that self-righteousness and foolish wickedness. Wisdom will help you ignore other people's words when they speak without mastering their own tongue. He says in chapter 7, verse 21, also do not take to heart everything people say, lest you hear your servant cursing you. For many times also your own heart has known that even you have cursed others. So wisdom says, you hear somebody cursing you, don't take it to heart. He then concludes chapter 7 with this observation in verse 29. Truly, this only I have found, that God made man upright, but they have sought out many schemes. And he's not wrong. God created man holy and righteous in his image. Our wickedness is our own doing, and we have done exceedingly well being wicked. He then begins chapter 8 with a question. Who is like a wise man, and who knows the interpretation of a thing? A man's wisdom makes his face shine, and the sternness of his face is changed. So what is the wise man like then, given that this is how the world is that we find ourselves in? Well, first he says that a wise man knows that God has instituted human authorities and that they are to be obeyed for our good. He says in chapter 8, verse 2, I say, keep the king's commandment for the sake of your oath to God. Do not be hasty to go from his presence. Do not take your stand for an evil thing, for he does whatever pleases him. Where the word of a king is, there is power. And who may say to him, what are you doing? He who keeps his command will experience nothing harmful, and a wise man's heart discerns both time and judgment. So secondly, a wise man knows that he has no power to delay death. Death is the cutting off, the separation of the spirit from the body, and the wise person knows that he has no power to retain his spirit in his body. So he writes in verse 8, no one has power over the spirit to retain the spirit. No one has power in the day of death. There is no release from that war, and wickedness will not deliver those who are given to it. A wise man knows that even though the wicked may not be punished swiftly in this life, yet it is still best to live in the fear of God and of his final judgment. He writes in verse 11, because the sentence against an evil work is not executed speedily, therefore the heart of the sons of men is fully set in them to do evil. Though a sinner does evil 100 times and his days are prolonged, yet I surely know that it will be well with those who fear God, who fear before him. But it will not be well with the wicked, nor will he prolong his days, which are as a shadow, because he does not fear before God. And a wise man realizes that sometimes the wicked do prosper in this life while the righteous suffer. Verse 14, there is a vanity which occurs on earth, that there are just men to whom it happens according to the work of the wicked. Again, there are wicked men to whom it happens according to the work of the righteous. I said, this also is vanity. So this should serve as a corrective to anyone who thinks that Proverbs and the path to wisdom that Proverbs taught us would be easy, or that it was a firm guarantee of how the world worked. It's not. It's not a guarantee of an easy, comfortable life. And then finally, Solomon says that a wise man recognizes the limitations of human knowledge and understanding. We are not God. We can't know everything. He says in verse 16, when I applied my heart to know wisdom and to see the business that is done on earth, even though one sees no sleep day or night, then I saw all the work of God, that a man cannot find out the work that is done under the sun. For though a man labors to discover it, yet he will not find it. Moreover, though a wise man attempts to know it, he will not be able to find it. And then in chapter 9, Solomon concludes that death is the great equalizer. It comes to all men. Good, evil, hardworking, lazy, it doesn't matter. All men die. Thus, we should live well and enjoy what we can of this life because it is a gift from God, even if we can't see beyond it. So he says in verse 7, go, eat your bread with joy and drink your wine with a merry heart, for God has already accepted your works. Let your garments always be white, and let your head lack no oil. Live joyfully with the wife whom you love all the days of your vain life which he has given you under the sun, all your days of vanity, for that is your portion in life and in the labor which you perform under the sun. And then verse 11 is an interesting bit of wisdom. He writes and he says, I returned and I saw under the sun that the race is not to the swift, nor the battle to the strong, nor bread to the wise, nor riches to men of understanding, nor favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. That's always interesting to me when science catches up with the wisdom of God's Word. In about 10 years ago, 10 or 11 years ago, Malcolm Gladwell published a book called Outliers, The Story of Success. It's a fascinating book. I read it a couple of years ago. And in the book, he studies software developers like Bill Gates and Steve Jobs. He studies professional athletes. He studies a number of different fields. And he concludes in the book that a large part of success in any of those fields had to do with timing that was beyond control of the person who succeeded. That they were successful not because they were so smart or they were so skilled, but simply because they were born at the right time. In fact, one of the more detailed ones that he looks at is the role that the month of your birth plays in your success as a professional athlete. Because youth leagues for many sports have cutoff dates. The cutoff date determines when you get into the league. And so if you get in because your birthday was this month and a guy with the birthday in the next month doesn't get in because of the cutoff date, then you get in a year earlier than he does, and you get more practice time. And so by the time you get to professional athletics, that extra practice time is added up to the point that he says at one point, he says, I looked at the rosters of soccer teams in Europe, and there are cases where you literally cannot find anyone born in the last 3 months of the year. In other words, you can be the most naturally gifted athlete in the world, but all that talent can't overcome the advantages of someone who simply had a chance to work harder because they were born 3 months sooner. Found the same thing in the hockey leagues in Canada, that majority of the hockey players' birthdays were in a three-month span because it gave them an advantage when they started in the youth leagues. Or as Solomon says in Ecclesiastes, no, it's not favor to men of skill, but time and chance happen to them all. So it is God's hand who determines these things. And life is uncertain for us all. He writes in chapter 10, verse 8, he who digs a pit will fall into it, and whoever breaks through a wall will be bitten by a serpent. He who quarries stones may be hurt by them, and he who splits wood may be endangered by it. I know firsthand the realities of that last part there. I split a lot of wood this past few months, and every now and then a piece of it will fly off and hit you in the shins, and it hurts. And some things in life are counterintuitive. The wisdom doesn't make sense to us at first glance. A dull knife is more dangerous than a sharp one. He says in verse 10, if the axe is dull and one does not sharpen the edge, then he must use more strength. But wisdom brings success. You have a dull knife, you have to push harder to cut. You're more likely to have an accident. So because of this uncertainty in life and the difficulty of knowing wisdom, the wise must sometimes act with the best wisdom that we have and leave the rest of it to God. So he says in chapter 11, verse 1, cast your bread upon the waters, for you will find it after many days. Give a serving to seven and also to eight, for you do not know what evil will be on earth. So the bread is an allegory for taking action, not letting fear of the unknown future paralyze us into inaction. Sometimes we have to act without knowledge or a guarantee of the outcome, and so this almost is like investing advice. Give a serving to seven or eight. You don't know which one is going to return a profit and which one isn't. But when you can know, use wisdom. He says in verse 4, he who observes the wind will not sow, and he who regards the clouds will not reap. But you can't always know. We don't always have a knowledge that guides and directs what we're going to do. So he says in verse 5, and as you do not know what is the way of the wind, or how the bones grow in the womb of her who is with child, so you do not know the works of God who makes everything. In the morning sow your seed, and in the evening do not withhold your hand, for you do not know which will prosper, either this or that, or whether both alike will be good. And then at the end of chapter 11, he addresses young people, which we also saw in the book of Proverbs. And he says, "Rejoice, O young man, in your youth, and let your heart cheer you in the days of your youth. Walk in the ways of your heart and in the sight of your eyes, but know that for all these God will bring you into judgment. Therefore, remove sorrow from your heart and put away evil from your flesh, for childhood and youth are vanity." So enjoy life as best you can. It's a gift from God, but know that there is a judgment day coming. And don't wait until you're old to give thought to God. Do it while you're young, before you experience the difficulties of life. And so he says in chapter 12, verse 1, "Remember now your Creator in the days of your youth, before the difficult days come, and the years draw near when you say, 'I have no pleasure in them.'" And then verses 2 through 7 is an extended metaphor for the body breaking down in old age. He talks about the sun, "While the sun and the light and the moon and the stars are not darkened, and the clouds do not return after the rain, in the days when the keepers of the house tremble and the strong men bow down, when the grinders cease because they are few and those that look through the windows grow dim, when the doors are shut in the streets and the sound of grinding is low, when one rises up at the sound of a bird and all the daughters of music are brought low. Also, they are afraid of height and of terrors in the way. When the almond tree blossoms, the grasshopper is a burden and desire fails. For man goes to his eternal home and the mourners go about the streets. Remember your Creator before the silver cord is loosed, or the golden bowl is broken, or the pitcher shattered at the fountain, or the wheel broken at the well." Mitchell Chase writes in his book, 40 Questions About Typology and Allegory, on this passage and says, "Using many metaphors, the author describes the physical deterioration of the human body. The hands tremble, the legs bend, teeth stop working, sight dims, ears can't hear as well, the voice lowers and gets soft, and eventually the cord of life itself is severed at the last exhale. We are witnessing the end of life as the human spirit returns to God." So you might notice in verse 7 is the basis for the language of our confession in the chapter that Brian is currently covering in the CLA. "Then the dust will return to the earth as it was, and the spirit will return to God who gave it." So Brian's going over chapter 31 of the state of men after death and the resurrection of the dead. And our confession reads there in paragraph 1, "The bodies of men after death return to dust and see corruption, but their souls, which neither die nor sleep, having an immortal subsistence, immediately return to God who gave them." And they got that language right here out of Ecclesiastes. Once that happens, any opportunity for serving God in this life is ended. For good or ill, you're done at that point. And then comes the judgment. So Solomon's instructions, his wisdom are, serve God while you're young, while you're able, because that's the only thing that counts. And that's his conclusion. He says in verse 13, "Let us hear the conclusion of the whole matter. Fear God and keep his commandments, for this is man's all. For God will bring every work into judgment, including every secret thing, whether good or evil." So that's what matters in life. Everything else is vanity. Proverbs taught us to live wisely so that we might enjoy the blessings of this life. Ecclesiastes teaches us that those blessings are meaningless if they are the end for which we live. There is no lasting meaning or in pleasure or riches or success for its own sake. They are to be enjoyed when done so in the fear of the Lord and not for their own sake. Ecclesiastes teaches us to prepare for our death by showing us how to live our lives now. How God is the only one who can give meaning to life. That God's ways are not always, if ever, able to be known and understood by us. That we all suffer the effects of sin and death. We all experience joy and frustration in our labor. Sometimes life does feel vain and empty. And in the end, Solomon searched for meaning in many, many places, but he only found it in fearing God, right where Proverbs 1, verse 7 had said that it was to be found. And then, so in the end, his message was this: search for meaning in the proper place, in the Creator, not in the creation. This is the best advice that Solomon can give us, but it still feels a little bleak and leaves us feeling uncertain that life is worth living at times. But think about Solomon. People came from near and far to hear the wisdom of Solomon in his day. We know that kings came from other countries to hear the wisdom of Solomon. And in Matthew 12, verse 42, Jesus said, "The queen of the south will rise up in the judgment with this generation and condemn it. For she came from the ends of the earth to hear the wisdom of Solomon, and indeed, a greater than Solomon is here." Jesus was the greater son of David, with greater wisdom than Solomon. Solomon searched out wisdom under the sun, but Jesus was before the sun, and then took on flesh under the sun. And then he lived life under the sun with perfect wisdom and with full confidence of what came after, because he knew, unlike Solomon, who had not experienced death and life beyond death. Christ knew what it would be. He lived in the fear of the Lord and in the joy of the Lord. And while Solomon saw that death came to all men, and after that, the judgment, Christ lived and died and rose again so that we might experience life beyond this life, the resurrection and perfection of our bodies, and eternal, meaningful lives with him in the kingdom, without any of those things that caused Solomon so much grief and consternation in this life, the things that led him to conclude that life was mere vanity. Those things will not exist in the kingdom. Solomon preached the wisdom of fearing God, and Jesus preached the message of repentance and an eternal kingdom of glory. For indeed, a greater than Solomon is here. And one day, we'll be with him. And so Solomon wants us to live our lives now with a knowledge of what is coming. Let's pray.